Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The government in Seattle has moved to make life easier for renters. Last month, the city passed a law requiring landlords to give potential renters credit for having alternative sources of income, like Social Security benefits, child support. Landlords will also have to offer an apartment to the first qualified renter who applies. Those new rules take effect next year. Meanwhile, Seattle is still a hard place to rent an apartment. This week, Capitol Hill residents are holding their first ever Renters Summit, where renters can compare notes and decide which new policies to lobby for. Mayor Ed Murray will be there, and so will Sean Liming. Sean has rented in Capitol Hill for 21 years.
After learning that 80% of the people on Capitol Hill rent rather than have a mortgage, 80% rent. And if we had a small percentage of those 80% show up, that's a significant amount of people. And I was thinking, when these people come together, we can figure out ways to help keep rent affordable for everyone.
What is one change you're looking for from the city?
One thing I would like specifically, because it has to do with myself, is people with criminal backgrounds, if they have a criminal background, that they're not discriminated against and they're allowed to rent an apartment.
You know, Sean, that landlords say they have just as much right to manage their property and make a living and decide who lives there as you do to overcome your criminal background.
Exactly. I think, though, that it's America. We always say second chance, a third chance, right? And I believe everybody gets a second chance. And if you look at my record after 1996, you'll see it's spotless. So I don't understand why I wouldn't be able to be considered as a fine candidate.
Let's talk about rent control, which is another issue you want to address.
Yes.
at the Renters Summit this weekend.
How
much do you think the city can restrict rent increases when there's a Washington state law that prohibits rent control?
That is true, but I believe it would be just a simple fairness issue that if you are going to increase the rent, that you give the renter more notice. I know that at the rent control or the renters initiative meetings that we've been going to, several people have been talking about if it's a $250 increase, you should give them 45 days notice. If it's a $500 increase, let's say 90 days notice, and then so on and so forth. If it's a $1,000, then it should be 120 days. It's just a fairness issue that if you're going to increase rent, please let people know in advance, because it gives them the option of either staying or trying to move and find something that's more affordable.
What else do landlords do that make it difficult for renters that you think can and should be changed?
Leases, I was surprised this year to find out that when my lease expired, I went and asked a manager, resident manager, to get another lease. And she says, no, you're now from month to month. And I was a little bit worried, but then I found out that everybody in my building, that's the typical thing that my building does, is after you are on a lease for a year, you go to month after that, and they never give you another lease again.
Sean, you live in Capitol Hill.
Yes, sir.
Arguably the most desirable neighborhood in one of the most desirable cities in America.
That is true.
Why don't you move someplace cheaper? Are you looking?
It's kind of the first time I was ever asked this question the other day is why not just go ahead and move somewhere else? And I thought about it, but then it's my home. It's where I live. It's been where I've been for more than 21 years. I'm entrenched. I feel safe. I don't mind having to move maybe to another place that's cheaper. It's not that. I'm entrenched up there. It's my home. I know everybody. Walking down the street, it feels like a small community to me because I see people I know and I wave to them. I feel like it's my neighborhood and I'm a steward and I'm there to protect it and keep it clean and make it run right. I feel as a person that rents there that I have this responsibility to keep Capitol Hill cool, if you will, and Capitol Hill fun. And I like
doing
that.
Are you keeping Capitol Hill cool?
I try. I could live elsewhere, but I don't know. It's my home.
This Renters Summit this weekend is just for renters, not homeowners. Why is that?
Right. I think that other people would be welcome. I think homeowners would be welcome. I don't see why they wouldn't. I don't want to have any sort of schism between renters and homeowners. I think we can work well together. I don't know if there will be many homeowners there, but I know that we have a lot of renters and they need help right now. Bring them together.
Mayor Murray plans to be at this Renters Summit.
He will be.
What do you want him to learn?
I think that he already has a pretty good idea of what we're going after and what we're about. I know that I just want him there to hear people's individual stories, but I'm pretty sure that he has a darn good idea of what's going on. We already put through one renters initiative. Actually, we put through two renters initiatives to the city council and to the mayor. And so he has an idea of what's going on. And I want him to hear now, just to actually put a face with a name and to see people and to meet with them.
You've been renting in Capitol Hill for 21 years.
Yes.
We've seen rents go up there in part because of the boom, Amazon and otherwise. So you have some pretty well-off renters now. Are renters divided against one another these days?
I would hope not. While I was out canvassing for affordable rent, I met a very young couple, 22 years old, and he was a new employee of Amazon. And he goes, you might think of me as your enemy. He goes, but I was born and raised and grew up in Auburn with the dream of always hoping to move to Capitol Hill because I loved the vibrancy and the excitability of Capitol Hill. You know, so I've always wanted to do it. And he goes, now I'm doing it. And I'm here. And he goes, yes, I am paying $2,000 for a small studio. He goes, so I would think that you may dislike me or I may be your enemy. He goes, but I'm actually here. I agree with you. He goes, I want affordable rent for everybody. He goes, because even if I work at Amazon making $80,000 a year, he goes, I still want affordable rent and I want to be able to put money away. And not everybody that's coming to Capitol Hill to pay the exorbitant amount of rents, they're not for, you know, high rents. And so I think that people that are paying high rent aren't the enemy. We can work together with them.
How do you plan to work together with those Amazon renters and others?
The renter summit's going to be the first thing. That'll be step one, getting everybody together in the same room and talking about it. When you have this, look at what things have happened. This is how the country was born. This is why we are the United States of America. When we get people together, people talk and people think about things. I myself actually don't really know how to help keep rent affordable. I think that I have some ideas in my head, but I know that other people have ideas as well. And when we come together and talk about them, we can start making solutions and start figuring out answers to the problems.
Sean Liming rents on Capitol Hill, and he'll be at the Renters Summit this Saturday at the Miller Community Center. I talked with a landlord last month about the problems he'll have complying with new requirements that Seattle has passed recently. We will tweet out a link to that conversation now at KUOW. Thanks for tuning into The Record. I'm Bill Radke. ITT Technical Institutes, the for-profit chain of schools, shut down suddenly a couple of weeks ago, stranding tens of thousands of students. The U.S. Education Department and nonprofits around the country are trying to help these students. KUOW's Patricia Murphy reports for the 6,000 of those ITT students who were veterans, the problems are especially complicated.
The day after Labor Day, ITT Tech students awoke to an email informing them that the school had shut down. David Lee Murphy Jr. was due to start classes at ITT Seattle campus. He'd paid his tuition and even bought books.
I was angry. Still am. They basically took their money and ran.
Murphy lost nearly a year of his GI Bill money at ITT, $7,000 a quarter that the government provided him to get a debt-free education. It's money that, as of now, he won't be getting back. Meanwhile, ITT's shutdown cost veteran Michael Horsley more than his education money. He could lose his home. That's because he gets a basic housing allowance from the VA that pays him $1,500 a month for his rent. But to keep getting it, he has to be enrolled in school.
Right now, I won't be receiving it. And this month, I won't be able to make enough to be able to pay for rent. First thing that came to my mind was like, well, how am I going to pay bills? How am I going to take care of my daughter?
It's unclear how many ITT Tech veterans relied on federal money for housing, but Derek Fronabarger, director of policy at Student Veterans of America, says some vets could become homeless.
A lot of students did not know this was coming down the line. You know, even having a week notice is just not enough to find another school or find a job to pay rent next month.
Fronabarger says his organization is one of many that have been helping former ITT Tech students decide their next steps. For right now, he says many are still reeling. Army veteran Bobby McGee had already earned his associate's degree in ITT's cybersecurity program at the school in Seattle. He says the news felt like a weight crushing him.
I was thinking about quitting school altogether and just get a job, whatever I can get as far as being a veteran.
But less than a day later, McGee changed his mind.
I gathered myself up and say, I can't just say, hey, it's ITT's fault. They are the fault. They are the reason why I did not make myself better. I can't do that because I'm still able to do whatever I need to do.
McGee used social media to reach out to other students, and 18 of them met up in the ITT Tech parking lot to do research and come up with a plan. They called Lake Washington Institute of Technology in Kirkland from the ITT parking lot and set up an appointment for the next day. Amy Goings is president of the school, and she says those veterans were among many ITT students who've come to enroll.
We had car fulls coming from around the region. We have seen 34 total ITT students as of a couple of days ago. 20 so far have registered for fall. So we expect that will continue. The fall quarter starts at the end of the month, so we have a little more time to work through their needs.
Bobby McGee, Michael Horsley, and David Lee Murphy Jr. all signed up, but it's not clear if they'll be able to keep any of the credits they've earned at ITT. If not, they'll be back to square one in their quest to earn college degrees. In the meantime, some members of Congress are pressuring the Education Department to grant ITT students relief from student loan debt they accrued at the school. And some lawmakers are pushing a bill that would replace the GI Bill money veterans spent at the school. I'm Patricia Murphy, KUOW News.
This is KUOW's The Record. Quincy Jones has terminal cancer. Not the Quincy Jones you're probably thinking of. This is 32-year-old professional comedian Quincy Jones from Seattle. In 2015, he was diagnosed with cancer and given a year to live. With the time he had left, he wanted to write and perform his own hour-long stand-up comedy special. Well, with the help of an appearance on The Ellen Show, HBO aired his special this spring. Quincy Jones told me it was actually a relief to get the diagnosis of cancer.
Because I'd been having my stomach fill up with fluid and getting my stomach drained for 6 months, you know, 6.5 months. And we didn't know why. And they were testing the fluid, they were testing my kidney, my liver, and they were testing everything. So when they did the biopsy and the results came back that it was cancer, it was like, okay, well, at least we know now. I'm not like just some freak who's just, you know, having his stomach fill up with fluid, you know. So it's kind of gives you a peace of mind knowing that at least it's coming from somewhere.
You've also said that you were offended to hear this prognosis.
Oh, yeah, man. There's no way I see myself withering away August 6, 2016, or a little bit before, a little bit after that, kicking the can. It just wasn't. My brain couldn't grasp that. I don't know geometry. I don't know trigonometry. Can't grasp that either. But it definitely couldn't grasp this doctor strolling in here, six people deep behind him, and saying, yeah, you got a year to live, so we'll get you on chemo.
And when did you start thinking about comedy?
I mean, you always, someone says, hey, you know, God forbid you ever got sick. Someone says, hey, you know, you have this set amount of time. Your life quickly comes into focus. There's no more blurry lines of maybe I want to do this or perhaps I'll do that. Your main job is to fight. Live long, fight to live longer. That's your main job. The second thing is to reflect on everything and be like, what do I want to have, to leave? I don't have a wife. I didn't have kids. Didn't have a dog. So what was going to be my legacy left in the world that I was here? Nothing. I had nothing in my head at the time. So I was like, well, I do comedy. I think I got the material. I'm funny. I got the chops. So let's do a special.
I like to drink, but I don't like to get drunk and get phone numbers because that's dangerous for me. See, I get too drunk and I forget the girl's name and I throw on my phone as a place that I remember. Like I was going through my phone on the way here tonight and there's a girl on my phone called McDonald's hookup chick. I'm confused. I don't know what that means. I don't know if we met at McDonald's and hooked up or if she works at McDonald's and she hooks it up.
I just wanted to put it out on YouTube. That's all I wanted to do is put it out somewhere so that way, God forbid, if I did die, then my legacy would have been here. There would have been some type of evidence that I existed on the internet or otherwise. And, you know, with the help of my friends, the Blaines, we made a good, compelling Kickstarter. You know, with the help of my cousin Alexia, we had a successful GoFundMe. And we just, you know, it all came together organically. And then that the Kickstarter went viral. And then I was in Ellen. And then I recorded a special 2 weeks.
Ellen DeGeneres.
Yeah, Ellen DeGeneres. And I recorded a special 2 weeks, you know, after she announced it. So we put the hour together in 2 weeks, you know. And it was, I give it a B plus. Give it a B, B plus special. I got room for growth. But it was also 2 weeks time. I don't know anybody who could put together an HBO special in 2 weeks time unless they were ready.
You were going to make this special completely about your diagnosis. Is that right?
No, I didn't really want to talk. I mean, I was going to do an hour of comedy.
Just the material you'd already been successful with.
Yeah.
I go wine tasting with some of my white friends, as if you go wine tasting with any other type of friends, right?
But there was no, you know, I had to write jokes about cancer. Because, you know, I don't even really choose to acknowledge it. I know I have it, right? I know it affects me. I know when I'm tired. I know why I'm tired. But I don't really acknowledge it and give it any strength in my life.
You said on stage you were, you didn't think you had cancer. You thought you had something else.
I thought I had celiac disease.
I self-diagnosed myself. I thought it was celiac disease. And let me tell you how relieved I am to find out it was cancer. And then I can eat regular pasta again.
Was there a point when you decided, I'm going to make this cancer diagnosis as funny as I possibly can?
For me, it was the decision to decide to talk about it or not.
Okay.
You get what I'm saying? I didn't want it to be a cancer special. I wanted it to be a special from a comedian who has cancer. You get what I'm saying? So it was never the intention to, like, bust out chuckles or for cancer. It was always to just be like, be funny for HBO. That's the goal.
By the way, when I say the title of your HBO special, which aired this spring, and it's you can still see it, it's a great title, Burning the Light, which I know because, as you know, I used to be a stand-up comic.
Yes.
What is Burning the Light?
Burning the Light is when a comedian gets is the light to wrap it up. There's usually light from the back of the room when you're on stage. And, hey, is you know, you got 1 minute, 2 minutes to wrap it up. And if you go longer, it's called burning light. So, you know, some people, I've seen people, I used to do it all the time.
I've
Mark Maron used it all the time.
Yeah.
So 5 minutes, you know, 10 minutes past the light, you just go longer. And so the prognosis was a year. And so that was the light. And I'm going past it. So burning the light was great.
How are you feeling now?
You know, it's an adjustment process to realize what I'll never be at 100% again, you know. So maybe 75, 80 is my new 100. And so it's adjusting to that. You know, it's adjusting where, like, I feel great. I'm going to walk from Chinatown in New York to Midtown New York. And, like, you feel good. And then you're like, yeah, I'm good. I did it. And then you stop. You're like, your body's like, all right. Gas gets overheating like cartoons, like steam coming out the ears. You're like, yo, we're overheating over here. Let's slow down. So that's what I feel like. It's just me learning to deal with the new limitations that I have to deal with.
What was that experience like getting your HBO special?
It was amazing. It was an amazing experience. I still haven't really had time to reflect on it, honestly.
Really?
I still haven't seen it.
What?
No, I haven't seen it.
Why not?
Well, I was a part of the editing process. You get tired of looking at yourself.
Okay.
Right? You know what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah.
it's like you do a great set. You're like, I did a great set. Woo! And then you hear it back. You hear all that stuff. You're like, oh, I don't really. And then you have to keep doing that for a month. You're like, so after a while, you're like, I think I remember what it was. You know, I felt good about it.
Haven't sat and watched it from beginning to end?
No.
Your dream. That's really interesting.
My dream. Well, I have a certain. I'm waiting for the right time to watch it. I know exactly where I want to watch it. I want to watch it on a plane.
Why a plane?
I just think that's where I want to watch it, man. I think when I'm on that, like, that's going to give it even more, even more reach. You know, that's exciting. Like when you get on Delta or whatever airlines, you get to HBO. I want to be on a plane. Like, I'm going to be watching me on a plane. That's kind of exciting and Inception-like also. But you know what I'm saying? Like, that's what I want. That's the way I want to see it.
So what's next?
That's where I'm at right now. I'm like, well, you know, I've written a show. I'm going to pitch that. And I've had some good meetings where...
A TV show?
Yeah, a TV show. And
episodic. not a special. A series.
Like I said, this new hour is going to be great, and we're going to fine tune it. And this is one where I want it to be my Chris Rock's Bigger and Blacker. You know, I want it. That's what I'm going for. And I have to work that out. Now, it's hard for me because I'm an improviser. I'm a riffer. You know, I like to do crowd work and engage with the audience and, you know, create this fun. But I realized to get to that Bigger and Blacker, you have to drill that hour down till you get every beat, every rhythm, every laugh where you want it to. And that's where I have to, that's where the practice comes. That's where, now that I got the hour of material I want, now that I got the structure loosely formatted where I want it, now we start whittling, carving it down until it's like the statue that I want it to be.
That was hard for Chris Rock to do. I mean, I it's exhausting knowing that you've got cancer and have beat the odds. It just feels exhausting that you're setting that goal that high. That's my reaction.
It is tiring. You know, life is tiring. You know, every day we get up, you take care of your kids, you shower, you take the wife to work or take them to school, and then you come to the studio and you record and you research. It's a lot of stuff. It's a routine. That's what life is about. It's a routine. The hardest things in life to attain and maintain is consistency, perspective, and balance. You know, balance is tough, you know, because you want to work hard, but you don't want to overwork. You know what I'm saying? Consistency is tough to get in, day out, and do what you need to do to survive, you know. We come to work 9 to 5, you know, 40 hours a week, and then you have to deal with kids, so maybe that's another 40 hours a week. But just, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, it's hard to maintain. That's the difficulties in life is balance and perspective and consistency. And so for me, once you realize those are the things, it's like, you just do what you got to do.
Cancer doesn't upend that whole formula for you?
I mean, I've already, right now, I feel like I'm riding a good wave. I've already done what they thought was impossible, you know? And so now it's like, why would I stop and reflect? It's like, why not start working on your next goal? You don't ever want to get to a point in your life where you're like, well, what now? You should always have something lined up, another goal. You know, next goal is a great special, not just a good special, a great special. And then, you know, make a great show, you know. There's always something that you could be doing, because that's the thing about comedy. As you know, there is no top. We keep doing this until we die. That's it. That is it.
So you don't feel that different from other people who are going to die? And there are some others.
Yeah, I mean, we're all going to die.
Exactly.
There's no guarantee, you know. Like, I just flew in a plane here, you know what I'm saying? Like, you never know. And that was the thing. I think that was the main thing about the prognosis. What put in perspective for me was, I didn't know when I was going to die before. So there's no guarantee I'm going to die here, you know, at that date either. So I'm back to square one of not knowing when I'm going to die. So all I should do is just maximize my time here and continue to do what I do, which is provide laughter. And that, to me, is my job.
Comedian Quincy Jones lives in L.A. now, but he was born in Seattle, and he's performing tomorrow night at Seattle's Neptune Theater. You're listening to KUOW Seattle. We're following the news for you. Yahoo just said that information associated with at least 500 million user accounts were stolen from its network in 2014 by what Yahoo says it believes was a state-sponsored actor. We'll keep following developments on that story as the day goes on. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Yes, cats can have cuteness, but they can be dangerous. House cats and strays together kill maybe billions of birds every year. With that in mind, bird and wildlife conservationists and feral cat advocates have teamed up to host an annual tour of Portland catios. That is catio with a C, an enclosed outdoor patio for cats. Advocates say it's the perfect way to let a house cat enjoy the outdoors without getting into trouble. EarthFix reporter Cassandra Profita took this year's catio tour and sent us an audio postcard.
We have a bird feeder out here in the water fountain. They just, the birds come here all day long, and they just watch it.
Yeah, it's like having a big screen on TV.
My name is Stanley Held. We're looking at an outdoor catio. It's an outdoor enclosure that I built for our two cats so that they could have outdoor time but be safe and not have to worry about them outside with dogs and cars. And they get their outdoor experience, but they're limited. It's got two different levels to it, so they can be on the ground and chew grasses. They can get up high and sprawl out in the sun. And then there's a window that goes into the basement. One of the windows has a pet door in it so that we can control their access to and fro. We get squirrels and we get birds that come into the backyard, and I don't want our cats to become killers. So the cats can watch the birds, watch the squirrels and birds can watch them, but they're separated and everybody's safe. You can see her, there she is. She's chewing on the grass right now. That's Samantha. That's the mom cat. She's eating a blue fescue grass. She loves it. Karen, Samantha's out. You're a good girl, Sammy.
You're a happy baby.
Good girl.
Oh,
yeah,
she says, I enjoy this.
My name is Karen Kraus. I'm the executive director of the Feral Cat Coalition of Oregon. Today is our fourth annual catio tour. It's a tour of eight catios. We have four on the east side, one of them on a houseboat or floating home on the Willamette, and three of them in southwest Portland. This is a record year. We had over 1,200 people sign up for this tour. We do a survey after each one of these, and 75% of the folks on the tour are interested in building one. If we can keep more cats from free roaming, fewer cats will become feral or stray. Letting a cat free roam outdoors, things can certainly happen to the kitty. At the same time, the cat can prey on wildlife. We're the first cat group that's working directly with a bird group on finding a solution. It's really nice to think about having a way that you could keep your cat from free roaming, and a catio is a great idea.
My name is Matt Freeland.
I'm Lisa Freeland. We have two cats that really seem to want to be outside with us when we are sitting outside, and so we thought it would be a good idea to sort of see what some of our options are and some of the designs and see if there's something that we could do to our own home. So
we have a covered pergola. We're trying to go out and get some ideas in terms of some different designs that maybe we don't use that entire space, but you know.
Right. Yeah. Just some options. So right now we have a screened windows, and so we open up the window and they just sit right on the sill and look out the screen quite consistently. Right. I mean, they kind of really like it. So.
And crying because they're not sitting out there with us. You know,
yeah.
So.
Exactly. So
you know, wintertime, come home from work, sit down, read the newspaper, cat jumps on your lap. But in the summertime, we're outside.
Yeah.
And the cats can't be with us.
We have some cats in the neighborhood that are kind of feisty.
And we know our youngest cat would just go bird crazy.
Yeah.
Primarily, it's just to allow them to get outside a little bit and kind of get a new experience for them.
Yep.
So is what we're really looking for.
Yeah.
So.
EarthFix reporter Cassandra Perfita took this year's catio tour. You know, a video would be helpful here. So we're tweeting on a link to a catio video right now at KUOW. Thanks for tuning into The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Felix Hernandez, the Seattle Mariners' dominant starting pitcher or a hittable has-been. He has looked like both at times the past few weeks. Last night, it was King Felix who took the mound, and the Mariners beat the Toronto Blue Jays. CBS sports writer Jonah Carey says the Mariners still have a slim chance at the playoffs.
Yeah, it's the proverbial must-win game. It was a team that the Mariners were chasing in the Blue Jays. They had to have that win. And, you know, Felix Hernandez has just not been good over the last couple of months. And really, you go back to 2014, it's been kind of a steady decline. He hasn't been the guy that he used to be. He still gets, you know, he's definitely getting by on guile now, where he once threw a 96-mile-an-hour fastball, more like 92 now. He's got to really be effective with his pitch placement, things like that. Did a great job, though, against the Blue Jays on Wednesday. Got that win for the team, or at least helped them get that win. And they're now decently positioned, only two games out of the wild card. It is doable at this point.
Why has Felix Hernandez fallen somewhat?
You know, there's a lot of theories about this, but I just chalk it up to pitching being really difficult, to be honest with you. He's thrown exactly to the letter 2,400 innings in the major leagues. That's a lot of innings. You know, he's the only pitcher, there are two pitchers, rather, in all of baseball who've thrown 200 innings the last eight seasons in a row. One is Felix, and the other one is James Shields. James Shields, who was a great pitcher, is now arguably the worst pitcher in all of baseball.
Yeah.
Because it's an unnatural act to keep throwing and throwing and throwing for years and years and years. You're going to wear down You're going to lose velocity. You're going to get worse with age. And so I think this is where we're at with Felix. Doesn't mean he can't be an effective pitcher. It just means that the world beater that he used to be, the Hall of Fame caliber pitcher, not sure that guy's coming back, unfortunately.
Well, if he'd have just lost that game and the Mariners had no hopes, the poor man could have rested. But now we're gonna need him more than ever. We're going to be whipping that horse down to the wire.
Yeah, no question. I mean, the good news is that the Mariners do have other effective pitchers. The emergence of Hisashi Iwakuma has really been a big help to the team. It's been great. But you're right. You know, Felix is definitely going to have to pitch well. He's still going to have a couple starts here left this season. And, of course, if the Mariners do make the you look for him to potentially start a wild card game. And if not, then be starting game one of an LDS if they're able to advance. So, yeah, of course. And, in fact, it would be the first playoff appearance of his storied career, the first time that he would ever have to extend the workload into October. So that would be an interesting test, but a good test to have. I think for a city that hasn't had playoff baseball in 15 years, everybody will take it.
Worst case, Felix never quite returns to top form. How screwed are the Mariners?
I mean, he hasn't been top form this year, right? And they're right in the mix. The thing about this team is that it is not just Felix anymore. They really do have a lot of good players. The bullpen is better than it used to be. So, you know, the good news here is they don't necessarily need him to be a superstar. It'd be nice, but they're in position now where they've got a more balanced roster because some of their young players have gotten better. I mean, that is the simplest way to win. You know, even if you're a team like the New York Yankees, go back to the 90s, why did they win? Yeah, they spent money, but mostly they won because they developed guys. If the Mariners want to be a successful team over the long haul, it's not so much get me peak Felix Hernandez, it's get me the next Felix Hernandez. That's the goal.
Felix Hernandez told the Seattle Times that he was angry. I don't know if he used the word angry, but he was motivated last night because he couldn't believe there was more cheering at Safeco Field for the Toronto Blue Jays than for Seattle. Should we feel awful about that?
Yeah, I guess my question is, the people that are in Vancouver and Calgary and Kamloops and Victoria, do they have jobs? I mean, how is it that all these people kind of left for 3 days and went to Seattle in the middle of the week? But, yeah, you know, the Jays really do have a lot of support in Western Canada. They very much, especially with the disappearance of my beloved Montreal Expos, I grew up in Montreal, they don't exist, and so all of the country embraces the Jays. I don't think it's a problem with the fans in Seattle, per se, as much as it is just people turning out. You know, the Jays fans just mobilizing and buying tickets. You know, but issuing the challenge, that's okay, I get that. You know, you want your hometown support, and hopefully if the Mariners keep playing well and they get back to the playoffs, heck, maybe they get a rematch against the Blue Jays at some point. And that would be a pretty interesting scenario in which they could maybe stick it back to them a little bit. So we'll see. You know, I'm going to credit this more to Canadian fans than besmirch Seattle fans. But certainly the gauntlet has been tossed by King Felix.
Finally, realistically, the odds that Seattle makes the wild card slot and makes the playoffs this season?
Mathematically, something like an 18-20% thing, I believe, is last check. Because the thing is, two games are not a lot. But the problem is you've only got 10 games left in the season, and even more so, you have all these other teams competing. So Houston is ahead of the Mariners right now. Detroit is ahead of the Mariners right now. The Yankees are a half game behind the Mariners right now. And that's not counting the two teams that actually hold the wild card positions, Baltimore and Toronto. So it's one of those things where, yeah, the Mariners could go 7-3 or 8-2, but if everybody else is going 6-4, 7-3, that's not going to be good enough. I don't think they have to run the table at this point. But they've got to come close. They've got to come up with a big finish, at least 8-2, to have a fighting chance at a playoff spot. And honestly, 9-1 or better might be the move here.
9-1 or better. Well, it starts with one game, and the Mariners open a series against the Twins in Minnesota tomorrow. Twins are the worst team in baseball. That helps. That was Jonah Carey I was talking to, sports writer, host of the Jonah Carey podcast. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Take a trip with me now, 25 years into the past. Remember what 1991 sounded like? Ah, Bryan Adams, and UB40, Naughty by Nature, CNC Music Factory, topping the charts 25 years ago. Maybe you can see why some music critics at the time were saying rock and roll was dead. Then this happened. September 1991, Nirvana's album Nevermind comes out. An unexpected, massive, giant hit, and with it and a few other tunes, Seattle becomes known as the epicenter of grunge. At the Public Radio Music Show Sound Opinions, hosts Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot say pop music was pretty bad before Nirvana broke through, but DeRogatis says rock and roll was not dead in 1991.
I mean, the cliched shorthand is that, you know, Nirvana came along, kicked Michael Jackson off the top of the charts, you know, and bands like Poison, the hair metal bands. You know, that is a reductive shorthand history that is has very little to do with history. You know, the fact is that for a decade or more after the initial punk explosion in England and in New York in the mid-70s, there was a vibrant and thriving American underground.
Yeah, I think the Pacific Northwest scene in particular, you know, had a lot of great bands in the 80s that we knew all about and would come out and see them when they would tour. You know, Wipers and Green River and Fastbacks and Melvins, these were great bands, and they just didn't happen to be charting. But rock was alive and very well, including in the Pacific Northwest. It was, to me, more a matter of time. I had a brother-in-law, I still have a brother-in-law, who would send me cassette tapes back in the day when cassette tapes were the coin of the realm, filled with the new sounds from Seattle. And I remember hearing bands like Mudhoney and Nirvana in their infancy because of that, and thinking, man, this is great stuff. Nobody could predict that this was one day going to be commercially acclaimed music as well as, cult status music. But it happened in a matter of years. And I think, as Jim said, the groundwork had been laid going all the way back to bands like the Ramones and the Clash and the Sex Pistols in the 70s. And I think it was, in a lot of ways, a culmination of all of that.
We remember the Nirvana album Nevermind as touching off the Seattle explosion. Why do you think Nirvana struck such a nerve with youth culture at that time?
Well, Generation X, demographically speaking, people born between, 62 or 64, the sociologists said it at, and the early 80s, are one of the smallest generations of American teens in history, sandwiched between this massive baby boom and the baby boom's offspring, the millennials. And it was a generation without an identity, a generation that felt it had been lied to. We grew up eating our Fruit Loops while having our cartoons interrupted on Saturday morning by the Watergate hearings. We're cynical and jaded. You know, all that slacker stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Richard Linklater's Slacker and Cameron Crowe's Singles filmed in Seattle, right? There's an element of truth there. We weren't going to be bought and sold, or we were going to fight it. And out comes this sound from largely from Seattle, but the rest of America as well, that is real, that is raw, that is authentic. And we connect to it. Now, I remember sitting with Kurt Cobain and Chris Novoselic and saying, boys, I don't understand. When I bought, Touch Me, I'm Sick by Mudhoney, as the single on Sub Pop, right? I thought this was the song that was going to change the world. Why wasn't that song Smells Like Teen Spirit? And they both said to me, honestly, we don't know why Smells Like Teen Spirit was Smells Like Teen Spirit. Mudhoney should have gotten there first, or Kurt would say the Melvins, although he would say that with a smirk because he knew you had to be a little bit more than a little bit twisted to love the Melvins.
How did big music, how did the major record labels react to the success of the Seattle scene, et cetera?
They were sharks at a feeding frenzy. You're talking about a major label industry that no longer exists anymore, and that to anybody under the age of 30, I think, is they can't even believe that it ever happened that way. If you've been watching HBO's Vinyl, that this kind of big corporate mentality ever existed in rock and roll. But they descended en masse with their Platinum Amex cards, taking any musician busking on the street in Seattle out to a $300 dinner and signing them to a recording contract that they would, get this allegedly big advance, but they'd have to pay it all back. The whole thing lasted 2 years, And by 1993, 94, Billboard ran a front page article. Greg and I had an interesting perspective on this because we had been to Seattle. We were both writing about the bands in Seattle. And then 2 years later, Billboard said, the new capital of cool in America, Chicago.
Yeah, you know, the industry is famous for co-opting good ideas. And then once it's co-opted, the idea doesn't become so good anymore. It becomes sort of a sellout notion. And I remember being in Seattle, you know, when Cameron Crowe was filming Singles, and the cynicism, the level of cynicism was just hilarious. I could compile a comedy album based on the response I was getting from various musicians and club owners and record store, owners in Seattle at the time all of this was going on. They knew it was a passing phase. And at the same time, you've got all these bands that didn't have a prayer of getting played on the radio. Commercial radio completely ignored, for years, even though they were great bands. Bands like the Butthole Surfers, the Jesus Lizard, the Melvins, getting signed to these major label deals. That, to me, was one of the most amazing aspects of this. And then they all got dropped. Two or three albums later, they're off the label.
Yeah, you know, if they're lucky, they got a new station wagon out of it. And right. That's about it, you know?
Right, but all this industry, it can't be said enough that in the early 90s, this entire alternative industry developed around what had been an underground scene for most of the 80s. This scene had been around for years. Lollapalooza, the traveling festival, the movie Singles by Cameron Crowe, the emergence of what became known as the alternative rock radio format. I mean, these kind of things couldn't have been imagined in 1988. And they all came true by 91, 92, 93. And as soon as we started to see this commercial tinge put on the whole thing, that's when it lost all its glow, all its innovation. And it was time to end it.
Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot from Sound Opinions. You guys often will pick a Desert Island Jukebox songs. You can't live without them. So what's a song from the Seattle scene you want to throw in that jukebox, Jim?
Oh, I'm going to go with a Mudhoney song. Like I said, Superfuzz Big Muff comes out. I bought it, at Pier Platters in Hoboken, New Jersey, on vinyl, Sub Pop record. I just love that record. I just loved it. And I think the song If I Think, right? Again, I think a lot of this has to do with pronouns. With Kurt, it was Here We Are Now, Entertain Us. With Mudhoney, it was If I Think, I Think of You. And it was, the humor in that song. First of all, one of the greatest guitar riffs in history, right? And then the humor of saying, if I think. And I'm not saying I do all the time, but on those rare occasions when I think, I think of you. It's a brilliant lyric. It's a brilliant vocal. It's an incredible guitar riff. And it's got that, it's got that Nirvana formula. The soft, sweet, loud, hard, fast, slow. It's a perfect song.
How about you, Greg?
Well, Mudhoney is a great choice. I love that band. Another band that I loved from Seattle during that era was Screaming Trees. I thought, unbelievable band. And to this day, I still stand by most of their records. Nearly Lost You, to me, is a great song. I just love that. I think it sort of gets the essence of that group, a little psychedelic, propulsive, those great Mark Lanegan baritone vocals. To me, it's a timeless sound. It transcends any way, any tagline or, this is the grunge era. No, this is just a great rock band with a great rock song. And I think, people 20 years from now will be discovering them and saying what a great band this was.
Is there a legacy of the Seattle music that we're talking about?
You know, Lester Bangs in the 70s did this famous three-chord history of rock and roll. It was his thesis that the three chords of La Bamba were the same three chords of Louie Louie, were the same three chords of No Fun by the Stooges, the same three chords of Blitzkrieg Bop by the Ramones, and today we could add the same three chords of Smells Like Teen Spirit, each played more nasty each time, each hopefully using that second person plural. We're in this together. Let's make a mess. I want to say lots of curse words here, right? Let's get in trouble is what we're about to do. There's a certain attitude to rock and roll, and it's we don't like the status quo.
On the 25th anniversary of Nirvana's Nevermind album, that's Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot, co-hosts of Sound Opinions, which you can hear on KUOW Sunday nights at 10 o'clock. Rock stars have backup bands. Every Broadway musical has a chorus. Ballet has the same kind of thing. It's called the corps de ballet, corps being French for body. These dancers really are the company's support system. KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman now turns the spotlight on the hardest working dancers you've never heard of.
If you want an idea of what the corps de ballet actually does, check out the classic Swan Lake. Act Two is the big moment. Tchaikovsky's famous music begins, and a line of women in white tutus and headdresses appears from the wings. These are the swans. At Pacific Northwest Ballet, there are 24 of them. They hop in unison onto the stage, gently flapping their arms like wings. They really look like a flock, not individual dancers if you're in the audience.
Honestly, if they can pick one out and learn their name, something's wrong.
That's Pacific Northwest Ballet's artistic director, Peter Bowl. He says in big story ballets like Swan Lake, the corps de ballet creates a mood for the audience. They're in the background, but their work is grueling.
The dancing is almost as challenging for the corps as it is for the principals, and certainly it's probably harder than what it is for some of the soloists.
The corps, it's a blessing and a challenge.
Emma Love Sudarth has danced with PNB's corps de ballet since 2009. She's been a snowflake, a peasant girl, and of course a swan. Sudarth says in a ballet like Swan Lake, the corps dancers need to match each other exactly. That's a problem when you want to stand out from the crowd so you can get a promotion.
You're moving as one. But then at the same time, you're trying to set yourself apart while matching the person next to you. And so it's a total oxymoron, basically.
Ballet isn't the only profession that requires a large supporting cast. For example, when Seahawks quarterback Russell Wilson calls a play, the offensive line goes to work. They make sure the stars like Wilson or former running back Marshawn Lynch can score.
Marshawn Lynch, still on his feet, has blockers now. He's dancing his way for the touchdown.
Ballerinas may not dance in beast mode, but Emma Sudarth says PNB's corps de ballet is just as important as football's anonymous offensive line.
I won't deny it gets frustrating at times to not be the person in who the spotlight is following around the stage. But at the same time, you know that performance wouldn't carry a millimeter of the weight that it carries without the corps.
Still, dancers like Sudarth don't endure years of training with the dream of spending their entire careers in the corps de ballet, according to her boss, Peter Bowl.
That's not necessarily why they walked through the door in the first place. You know, it's not what they were told or promised or what the storybook said.
The storybook dream is to be that prima ballerina at center stage, showered with flowers and applause. Bowl does often feature his corps members in solo roles, but the reality is he can't promote them all to principal dancer.
It's frustrating in ways because a lot of them earn that soloist promotion, but I still need 16 females in that line. So I can't reward everybody with that promotion because I have to keep the balance of the company in a certain way because we're going to do Swan Lake again.
Elle Macy is 23. She's been in PNB's corps de ballet for 2 years. She remembers the first time Peter Bowl gave her a featured role.
And when I saw that on the casting, I was like, Elle Macy, you have to live up to this. I wanted to be the perfect version of myself, and I wasn't there yet.
Macy hopes someday she'll be the one Bowl singles out for that rare promotion. Until then, she'll work hard in the corps de ballet. She says at PNB, the corps really is like family. That wasn't her experience at larger companies like New York City Ballet.
I would go to the summer intensives there, and it was very dog-eat-dog. The company didn't need you, you needed them. And then you come here, and everybody's important, and everyone knows that they can't get through it without each other, or at least there's a little bit more of that mentality.
Emma Suddarth agrees. In fact, she married a fellow Corps member. Suddarth says as long as she gets a chance to show her stuff from time to time, she's content where she is.
It's about growing as an artist. It's about getting those opportunities that further me as an artist. It's not about, you know, what the title is after my name.
At age 27, Suddarth doesn't have all that many more years as a professional dancer. Like football, ballet's hard on the body, and the careers are short. But until she decides it's time to retire, you'll find Emma Love Suddarth on stage, twirling with her friends in the Corps de Ballet. At Seattle Center, I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News.
You can see some of Pacific Northwest Ballet's Corps de Ballet members at our website, KUOW.org. PNB opens its season this weekend at McCall Hall at Seattle Center. On KUOW's The Record, now here's some pop culture that's new and old. Amazon is releasing trailers for its latest original show, written, directed by, and starring Woody Allen. Allen says lots of media companies wanted a series from him. Amazon stood out.
Amazon was the most persistent, and they kept at it, and they wouldn't take no for an answer and kept improving their offer all the time. And so finally, they won me over.
Sounds like Amazon. The show's called Crisis in Six Scenes. It debuts next week. And I hope you'll get KUOW's podcasts. The Record, this program right here, Week in Review, KUOW News, Radioactive, and more. You can listen to our podcasts online at KUOW.org. Or if you're on a phone, just search KUOW in your very favorite podcast app. Thanks for tuning in.